Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 135, recorded January 13th, 2014. Brad Stone. Triangulation is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place. Get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get the most interesting, brightest, most fascinating people on the internet. We sit down with them, we spend an hour, and I'm really excited about this one because I've been reading the book and I cannot put it down. Brad Stone is here. He was at Newsweek for a long time covering Silicon Valley, then the New York Times, most recently for Bloomberg Business Week. He has written a couple of books, but his newest is a great read. It's called The Everything Store. It's all about Amazon and Jeff Bezos. Great to have you. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
Oh, the age of Amazon. And it really is the age of Amazon. There's no question about it. But I love reading from the beginnings in the book because it wasn't a sure thing by any means.
It really was fun revisiting those very early days, 1994 and 1995, because so much had yet to be figured out. I mean, today, if you're going to start an online retailer, a company like Amazon, you're going to start it on Amazon's own servers, right? You'll use AWS or another cloud service. Back then, they had no idea what was coming. There were no infrastructure technologies. No one had even created the shopping cart or the payment mechanism before. And the most interesting thing is they really had no way to forecast the demand back then when it's Jeff Bezos and a couple other folks in the garage in Bellevue, Washington. They put their shingle out, and almost immediately they're overwhelmed by demand, and they're racing to keep up. It's the sort of kind of frenetic demand that hits all those early stage internet companies, and Amazon was right in the thick of it.
This book is really three things. I've been telling everybody, read it. Because it's the Jeff Bezos story. I mean, he's a really interesting fella. It's the story of an iconic company in the internet age, but it's also really a good business book because a lot of what Bezos did and tried, some of it didn't work, some of it did, was really different and innovative. He really thought out of the box, and it seems from the book that he really was determined. He had a vision, and he was full speed ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great to hear you say that. I really look at the book as something that other entrepreneurs, yes, really, anyone in business can learn from. The first thing to understand about Amazon and Bezos is that, by virtue of probably because of their early struggles, how much trouble they had keeping up with that demand, ultimately the enormous skepticism they faced from outside investors during the dot-com bust, they really kind of centered around a conviction that they had to redo everything, kind of rebuild, reinvent, rethink everything from the ground up. That's really when Amazon started to take off, is, a decade ago when they're building their own supply chain software, and rebuilding their FCs from the ground up. The conviction there was that this is, the age of the internet is going to be, there's going to be a different relationship between companies and their customers. And Amazon right now is such a peculiar, idiosyncratic creature. I mean, they run their meetings in unique ways. And it's really because, they're inventors, and they really think about new and better ways to do almost everything.
How much access did you have? Did Bezos cooperate with you on this?
I would say halfway. And the first thing to understand about Amazon is, very much like Apple, it is, monstrously secretive. Right. They cultivate an air of mystery and mystique around them, and they communicate with the press only in very targeted ways. So I knew starting off that I was never going to get the full level of cooperation from Jeff Bezos. It's not who he is. He prefers to talk to his customers. But I did have, at the time, a good enough relationship with the company to approach them to tell them what I was doing, and really to convince Jeff to allow me to talk to some of his senior executives, his parents, some of his friends, his colleagues in the S team or the senior leadership team at Amazon. So I got very good and really unprecedented access from Amazon. In terms of Bezos himself, I mean, of course, I would have loved some Steve Jobs, Walter Isaacson style collaboration, but that was different circumstance, yeah, obviously. Yeah. I have talked to Jeff probably a dozen times over the past 12 years, and I drew on those interviews and then interviews I subsequently did, even as I was working on the book, but really that were tied to Amazon product launches, things like the Kindle Fire.
You tell the story of actually telling Jeff that you're going to write the book in person.
That's right. So I came into this meeting with a press release, because that is how new products are developed.
That was the strangest thing. Yeah. In order to pitch at Amazon meeting, you have to write a press release, in effect. And you read it out loud in the meeting. So you said, I'm going to take a page from that book and do it for Jeff.
Yeah. And I think he enjoyed that and he laughed a little bit. And it was sort of, bowing to Amazon's culture. It was a starting point for the conversation. All meetings at Amazon are started by reading these six page documents. It's another way in which the company is just very, very, very unique.
You refer several times. In fact, you refer in that scene to Jeff's laugh. He laughed when you started reading the press release. Let me play a little bit, because it comes up a lot in the book. You wouldn't think it's important, but are you getting the audio from this? No, you're not. We're seeing him laugh, but let me see if I can get the audio out of this for you, John. I don't know why it's not playing it. What is it about Jeff Bezos' laugh? It's unique.
Oh, I mean, it's completely unique. Although, as I found out in the research of the book, and maybe we'll get to this, there are some interesting sort of family connections to the laugh. But
you mean his parents laugh like that, or his sister laughs like that?
His biological father, actually, who I tracked down for the book.
Wow.
While he's intense and he's demanding, he's also he's got an outsized personality, and he's fiercely intelligent. But the laugh, it's an endearing, maybe slightly scary attribute. And it's, of course, the first thing that everyone at Amazon instantly knows about their boss. And it's, in fact, probably a good way to track him in the hallways, too.
Yeah, he has a I wish I could play it for you. Kind of. We'll put it in post. He has quite a honking laugh. You said that at the time you had good relationship with Amazon. When the book came out, did those sour?
I don't think in general it's a company that
they're secretive.
They're secretive and appreciates this kind of investigation. So we know that they didn't really love the book. Of course, sort of somewhat famously, Mackenzie Bezos, Jeff's wife, delivered a notorious 1-star review on Amazon.
On Amazon.
Yep, I got some pushback from the PR folks. My sense is that they didn't like it, but I'm sort of hoping that over time, they come to see it as really a balanced account. I mean, I just know from the feedback I've been getting that there are a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of business folks that are tremendously inspired by my account of Amazon. So what I tried to do, it's a polarizing company, and Amazon has many critics and many enemies. There are many employees that worked there and left and found it to be exhausting, and I tried to represent all the views about this incredibly interesting and disruptive company.
Actually, it's funny because Shel Kafin, after Mackenzie Bezos gives you a 1-star review, comes back, reads the book, and gives you a 4 or 5-star review, saying, I was there. Yeah, he wasn't too far off.
Yeah, and right. And the review section on Amazon of the book has become a little bit of a battlefield.
So great.
For people representing their different views of the company.
Yeah. So you start, it's interesting, you start with Jeff Bezos in sixth grade. And even then, he was kind of an odd kid. Super smart, right?
That's right. He is attending a school for the gifted outside of Houston. And the reason that, you know, I was able to even start the book with this account was because there was actually an author, a woman named Julie Ray in the 70s, who is writing a book about gifted education programs in Texas. And she visits this school, and Jeff Bezos is depicted in the account as a sixth grader under an assumed name, but we now know that it was Bezos. Julie Ray calls him Tim. And the book, which I found actually in the Houston Public Library,
never published. It was an unpublished book.
Right. Right, you know, sort of self-published. Right. And but it's in the Houston Public Library, and it chronicles a day in the life of Jeff Bezos circa, I think it was like 1973, and it shows that his teachers really regarded him as a special student.
Yeah.
And in fact, the quote from Juan is, you know, there's really no limit to what this kid can achieve given the right guidance. And now we see, you know, 40 years later that was definitely true.
That's quite a, you must have like high-fived yourself when you found, how did you find out about this?
That particular, anecdote had been referenced in previous Bezos profiles in the late 90s. No one had ever found the book or tracked down Julie Ray, which I did, but Jeff's family members had talked about that book existing and other writers had referenced it. I set out to actually find the thing. So it was a nice moment when I did locate it in Houston.
Yeah, no kidding. It's a great way to start the book. So Bezos, already a smart kid, kind of an unusual kid. He goes into finance, right? He goes to work for D.E. Shaw.
Yeah, that's right. And this is in the early 90s. He's had a couple of other jobs on Wall Street. But D.E. Shaw is important because it's a quantitative hedge fund. So it's a firm that's using algorithms, kind of special, you know, and computers to execute trades. But it doesn't really see itself in that way. It sees itself as a technology company whose first market is finance. And David Shaw, of course, is a esteemed computer science professor and had worked at Morgan Stanley. But he was kind of thinking big about what D.E. Shaw could become. And when he saw the internet blossoming in the early 90s, he started getting together with one of his smart young vice presidents, Jeff Bezos, and they started brainstorming new ideas on the internet. And it was these meetings and other meetings that generated a couple of ideas inside D.E. Shaw. They had, of course, you might remember Juno, which was a free email company, advertising supported. They had a financial services firm that D.E. Shaw spun out. And then the idea for the Everything Store, or basically, you know, the idea of could you create a intermediary between customers and manufacturers on this new thing called the World Wide Web. And Bezos, who is very, you know, entrepreneurial minded, is dreaming of starting his own company, takes that idea, refines it, distills it to the idea of selling books. You know, he thinks that this product category is well attuned to selling online because you can create great selection far more than a traditional bookstore. But he brings that back to David Shaw and he says, I'd like to go do this on my own. I want to be a startup founder. And that is the very beginning of Amazon.
That's pretty cool. Did Shaw fund it?
No. There was, of course, that opportunity. Shaw ended up funding the other technology companies that spun out of D.E. Shaw. But I think Bezos wanted to do it on his own. You know, he saw what the benefits were towards of ownership and maybe he saw also what the disadvantage might be of staying too close to D.E. Shaw and to essentially, you know, having a boss in David Shaw who became the chairman of some of these other technology companies. So, no, he broke off and went off on his own direction. And David Shaw even said to him, you know, we might compete with you one day. And then Jeff moves all the way across the country. And a couple of years later, after the do not compete agreement with D.E. Shaw expires, he just starts hiring D.E. Shaw folks. And a lot of the early important executives at Amazon actually were colleagues of Jeff's at D.E. Shaw.
Rick Dalzell goes along. His wife, Mackenzie Bezos, was a D.E. Shaw employee.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Rick Dalzell comes from Walmart a little later.
Oh, that's right. Walmart. That's right. Yeah. That's a great story, too, because Bezos not only raids his former employer, but raids Walmart because he needs retail experience.
Well, he thinks Walmart has the answers to this, you know, massive onslaught of demand and you know, the challenge that Amazon faces in getting good in logistics, they do hire a lot of people from Walmart.
And it's a mismatch. It's a horrendous mismatch.
It really is, right. And not only does it create a poaching lawsuit between the two companies in, I think, 98 or 99, but yeah, a lot of those Walmart folks don't work out and leave soon after. And the fundamental lesson, I think, that Amazon takes for it is that their challenge is unique. You know, they're getting products from, you know, the manufacturer to the distribution center and then to people's homes. You know, Walmart's in the business of sending, you know, huge pallets twice a day to its stores. So Amazon really ultimately realized that they needed to rethink the underlying questions posed by their distribution center. And really the key guy there then is Jeff Wilkie, who's really one of the most important executives at Amazon. And he comes over from Allied Signal in 1999 and is as responsible as anyone for building the fulfillment centers.
So initially, in the early days of Amazon, the great push is software, because nobody's really written an e-commerce site. In fact, it's Amazon that comes up with the one-click, patents it, ends up saying Barnes & Noble can't use it. It was originally, I mean, if you think about it, a software company.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the software is no good if you can't deliver products.
Right, right.
And you talk about one of the brilliant insights that Jeff had, and I don't know if this is still true, is that his customers pay him immediately for these books, but he's got 90 days to pay the publishers for the books, gives him 3 months of cash that he can play with.
That's right, a very advantageous business model. And one of the reasons why he was able to raise so much money during the dot-com boom, because the savvy investors saw that you know, there was a unique return on investment capital, that they really had a business model that was you know, much more powerful and had this indigenous advantage over the offline retailers. But yeah, you made an interesting point about those early kind of software features like one click, like, you know, online reviews, recommendations. You know, these are great customer features and we know them well. But, you know, also to put it in context, like Amazon in the late 90s is looking for any advantage it can find.
Right.
You know, there are other sites that sell books.
Right.
Barnes & Noble's getting into the market. You know, Walmart's coming in. And Bezos has an early lead, but he's really looking for, you know, ways in which to kind of build a moat around his business. And, you know, one click is his, you know, kind of cleverly and maybe somewhat ruthlessly using the patent system. But all these other features are ways in which Amazon became the go-to destination for online shoppers. You know, without it, without those things, without the critical mass of reviews, without the recommendations, you know, it would have been kind of apples to apples in terms of Amazon versus Barnes & Noble or versus Walmart. But, you know, it's by becoming a technology company and investing in these features that Amazon really distinguishes itself from the pack.
You talk about what the five or six principles of Amazon. And number one has to be, and was from day one, it sounds like, customer focus.
Sure. No, absolutely. You know, and it sounds, you know, like we're carrying Amazon's water a little bit, but they really do. You know, they really do start from the customer and work backwards, as they say. You know, there are so many experiences you can have with companies now where, you know, they do things that make you scratch your head. You get on an airplane and they're blaring an advertisement for everyone to hear. You know, little kind of customer hostile things.
Yeah.
And you know, Amazon is a company, for all its faults, that is going to put the customer at the very top of its prioritization list. And you know, they have ads on the Kindle Fire, but they function as screensavers,
right.
And they're very clear that they're taking that money and they're using it to reduce the cost of the hardware. So, you know, it's there may be some disadvantages to this approach. You know, the way in which they treat their own employees, for example, or the way in which they've entered into business dealings with partners and then ended up, you know, creating a lot of animosity with that partner, and in some cases, lawsuit. To Amazon, the customer is clearly at the top of the list, and they will alienate almost every other constituency. Sales taxes are another example. You know, they'll alienate almost every possible constituency in pursuit of pleasing their customer and putting their customer first.
But it works because, and you said we don't want to carry water for Amazon, but in fact, I realize I do have this. I love Amazon, and I think its customers tend to love Amazon, right?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. In fact, I tweeted today, a brand, top 10 brands, top, I think, 20 brands, and Amazon was number one.
Yeah.
And Kindle was number 10.
Wow.
So they had two there in the top 10. And, you know, clearly, for all the criticism they get, they're speaking to customers. And look, big retailers, as we've seen with Walmart or, any other really big retailer over the last 100 years, you get to a certain size and you kind of end up crushing the small guy, the sympathetic mom and pop merchant, and your customers, while they might like low prices, they end up distrusting you. And Amazon, I think, by virtue of its innovation, really, and its focus on the customer, has managed to largely avoid being fitted with the kind of black hat of the big, ruthless retailer. They do get criticized for the way they treat workers in their fulfillment centers, for their avoidance of sales tax, for some other things. But really, it's remarkable, by and large, the halo that continues to exist over this company.
It is remarkable. It is quite amazing. There are quite a few bodies along the way, and you talk about a lot of them. Let's talk about the first Christmas. Amazon has gone from selling just books to selling toys, which turns out to be a no-win proposition for the retailer. Toy companies have a death grip on the business. You have to order ahead of time. Whether the toy is going to be a hit or not, no one knows. Jeff says, we want to have... At one point, he says... What do they call them? Jeff's fever dreams? At one point, he says, we want to have one of everything in our warehouse.
That's right. That's right. I had a lot of fun with 1999 and evoking that time in Amazon's history, because he's just got his foot on the accelerator. And he's got all this money from the IPO, and he's raised a lot of debt, and because he's going for it. He believes he can become the everything store.
Even more so, he's smart. He goes to the bond market. And he goes to the European bond market. He's borrowing money at 6% because he knows he needs cash.
And it's a land rush, and he thinks he can get to all these product categories before anyone else and make the Amazon brand very flexible in customers' minds. And yet, he's basically taking, MBA graduates fresh from Harvard and saying, go build our toy business, go right. build our electronics business. And they have no idea what they're doing. They're reading analyst reports as they go to the toy fair. And Bezos is like, I want 150 million of inventory. And everybody's freaked out. And there's all sorts of great stories from that time, including buying the Beanie Baby stock from Toys R Us and just having it all shipped to Amazon's fulfillment center. They're willing to do anything.
That's the kind of relentless vision that is the difference between winning and losing in this business. You tell the story of Bezos telling a group of Harvard students, Barnes & Noble's not going to win because they're a brick-and-mortar business. They will never put their best people on the internet side because they can't afford to. We are all internet. We're going to win.
It's amazing how clearly he saw that.
He saw that. He knew it.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, history has completely proven him right.
So software first, but now you've got to fulfill. You've got to send people stuff. So they get a warehouse. He calls the temp company. He says, "Give me everybody you cannot place anywhere else because they've got piercings, face tattoos. Just give me here. Give me anybody." And it's just like, I think even from day one, it must have been a horrific job. But even these employees seem to do it. You tell about the first Christmas, Amazon Saves Christmas, where they realize they're not going to get these products out.
And right.
Everybody, and even from the executive suite, goes to the warehouse.
Right. Yeah. For the first couple of years, they did do that. They sent their employees from Seattle into the fulfillment centers. At that point, they had at least two, and in 2000, 2001.
They have 91 now.
They had a couple. Right now, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't. I mean, I think there is some kind of training that happens at Amazon where executives at a certain level can go and spend some time in the fulfillment centers. But then it was everyone, two in the hotel room, working the graveyard shift. You know, it was amateurish, right? I mean, it was unsustainable. And yet, you know,
but
as
people
funny
did it. Was it because when you talk to these employees, and many of them quit eventually, they just burned out. But at the time, they threw themselves into it and they loved it. Why?
Well, I mean, some loved it. And maybe in retrospect, they're more nostalgic about it. But yeah. it was team building, and it was, you know, they believed in brand promise. And you know, look, I mean, Bezos is a very inspirational figure. I mean, and over the years, Amazon in some ways has been compared to a cult. And of course, you know, it is a technology company very much like, you know, Microsoft back in the day or Google today, where, you know, employees have a lot of loyalty and are very inspired by the founder, you know, the guy who has proven himself right and prescient so many times over the years. And back then, you know, they were going into battle, you know, because they believed in the leader and they believed in the company and they had stock in the company. And so there was a lot of self-interest there as well.
Actually, this one of the criticisms Mackenzie Bezos leveled at you in her famous Amazon review is that you don't talk about all the people who were, you know, loved this and were happy about it. You talk about people who were burned out and troubled by it, and I don't feel that that's actually a fair criticism of you. To me, the fascinating question is, how did Bezos inspire people to do this and get them to make this company fly? Because without that, another principle that you mentioned is frugality, and very famously, Bezos refused to pay parking for employees who had to come to the offices in downtown Seattle. He made everybody fly economy. Even when he flew in a private plane, he said, "I'm paying for this, not Amazon." That's part of the deal too. Frugality is what, you know?
Absolutely. And I think he takes that from Sam Walton's autobiography. And of course, frugality is a big value at Walmart and at a lot of retailers, because your ability to set low prices is based on your cost structure. And, you know, you've got to keep it low if you're going to create an efficient cost structure that scales. And right. And so it's I mean, Bezos has cleverly kind of woven that into the Amazon culture in kind of interesting ways. You know, people setting up their own door desks or, flying coach class. I mean, a lot of Amazon employees are kind of proud of that, because, you know, the mentality is that you're giving that back to the customer in the form of low prices. So people can be very passionate about that. But others aren't. You know, others find a more comfortable lifestyle at a Google, you know, or at a Microsoft. I tried to represent both, you know, both attitudes, and so I was sort of surprised in Mackenzie's review when she sort of saw it more as one sided. I think that speaks more to the kind of the kinds of coverage that penetrate the bubble there, right, at Amazon. You know, I guess maybe they're more used to one-sided or more sycophantic accounting. But, you know, Amazon's too interesting, too transformative a company to just see it in that way. And I really wanted to, you know, take the full account and look at all the sides and a lot of the praise and love for the company and a lot of the fear that exists out there as well.
I'd have been very suspicious if the book had said, "Everybody loves Jeff. Jeff is a wonderful person, and they'll do anything for him." And it's much more nuanced than that. There's also a review from Rick Dalzell, who worked at the beginning and retired for 10 years. He takes you to task, saying, "You say Jeff Bezos' laugh is punishing. It's not just punishing. It's also endearing and warm and lovable." I think these are nitpicking. It seems to me, not having worked inside Amazon ever, that you've done a very interesting and nuanced story that is, I have to say, just fascinating. We're talking to Brad Stone. He's author of a brand new book called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. It's, of course, available on Amazon. I'm listening to it on Audible. It's a great listen on Audible. I highly recommend it. We'll have more with Brad and your questions, too, if you're in the chat room and you're watching live in just a minute. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. Another interesting story by a founder, a guy who was CEO of PayPal and Intuit. We had him on this show, in fact, about a year ago, talking about the idea, money and authentication. And he had just founded this new thing called Personal Capital. I signed up then, and I have to say, I am a big fan. I'm really happy to talk about it on the show. Personal Capital is a website you go to. They actually have apps for the iPad, the iPhone, the Android devices too. You put in your financial stuff, and it helps you make sense of your financial life. The kind of the catch 22 of your financial life is the more progress you make, the more complicated it is to manage. You've got checking and savings and retirement and credit accounts, and you've got investments, you've got mortgages, you've got loans. And it's very difficult to plan for your future when you can't see it all in one place at one time. Personal Capital gives you a dashboard, a financial GPS, so that you know where you stand, and then they'll give you great help. It's a next-generation financial advisor planning for your future. And no matter where you are in your financial life, this is the time to do it. I have to say, the younger you are, the better. This is now the time to do it, especially for you. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. That's the website. This is free. It doesn't cost you anything. If you visit right now, you can take a look at it. They'll welcome you with open arms. And what was Mr. Harris's interview on Triangulation? Let's see if you can find that show, because it would be worth going back and listening to him talk about this stuff. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. I've been a member now for a year, and that's really been a great help. Our guest is Brad Stone. He is at Bloomberg Business Week, where he's a senior writer there. I should ask you, just as this as it began, you saw on your Bloomberg wire there that Google bought Nest for $3.2 billion. I know it's not the scope of the book. What do you think?
an amazing deal. I actually had a theory that it would be Apple buying Nest and restoring Tony Fadell to the Apple leadership team at some point.
He was the designer behind the iPod. That's
right. It would make so perfect sense to bring those home unloved home products, smoke alarms and thermostats into the Apple ecosystem and extend iOS into the home in that way. And I never considered Google buying it, but it makes sense. Right now we've got this ecosystem battle of Apple versus Google and perhaps potentially versus Amazon to extend these mobile operating systems into all corners of our lives. And we're going to see, wearables heat up this year and perhaps connected TVs and Android, another avenue of expansion for an operating system like Android is into our home appliances. And, Fadell and his leadership team at Nest have kind of shown that they can, take these unloved devices and make them a lot more interesting to customers. So, I thought it was an obvious kind of target for Apple. So maybe they've lost an opportunity there, but interesting for Google. And, another sign with the Boston Dynamics robot expansion, that Larry Page's Google is expanding on so many different dimensions. It really is amazing. And it'll be interesting to see whether the Justice Department or the FTC give this the kind of careful review that they've given other Google transactions in the past, like Motorola. These questions and fears about a company's expansion tend to build. And here with, a $3.2 billion acquisition?
Yeah.
There will certainly be a lot of people looking at this deal.
3.2 in cash, it's pure cash. Like, here's a check for $3.2 billion.
A great deal for Nest and its backers.
Holy cow! No kidding. Yep. I think you nailed it. I think the battleground. It's clearly the battleground is the Internet of Things. We're seeing processors move from computers to the periphery, and now everything is smart. Everything has a processor. Everything's connected via the internet. But there's an area that is ripe for exploitation, that's the connected home. And no one has solved this. There's 18 different standards. You've got every Zigbee, from Zigbee to X10.
Right.
And nobody's figured it out. Google's already kind of indicated that they're interested in this space. I think that they're well positioned. And you're right, Apple might have missed a bet, although I think you need a Google, frankly, more than you need an Apple to do this. So it'd be very, and Apple's terrible at internet services. So I'd kind of hate to see my Nest on the iCloud. It scares me. Anyway, the Google press release quotes Larry Page as saying Nest's founders Tony Fadell and Matt Rogers helped build a tremendous team. He mentions the products, the thermostat, the Nest thermostat, and the smoke and CO detector. But he mentions the team first, and I have to think it's the people that they're most interested in, as well as the products are selling okay. Apple does sell Nests at the Apple company store. I know I bought one there.
For now.
For now, yeah.
We'll see if tonight they're still there.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Maybe they'll buy, next they'll buy Philips Hue. Anybody who uses this stuff, as I do, you've got all this stuff. Nothing talks to anything. It all kind of promises it will. Be great if I could walk in the door with my Android device or my iPhone and have everything just kind of talk to everything else. I would really like that. So we'll see if this happens. Brad Stone is here to talk about Amazon, though, and Jeff Bezos, a fascinating character. Over 300 interviews go into his new book, The Everything Store. When you said that Bezos' original idea was a bookstore, do you think he always wanted to do The Everything Store?
Yes, I do. I think that for the first couple of years, that was only in the back of his mind. It didn't seem practical. Amazon really was an online bookseller. It was unclear that, inconceivable that the capital environment might exist to fund this wild expansion into other product categories. But around 2006, 2007, when the first venture capital money came in and Kleiner Perkins invested in Amazon, you know, I think Bezos saw the kind of valuations he was getting and realized that the opportunity did exist. And then right away, you know, we see that expansion. And in fact, in my talking to the very earliest executives at Amazon, at least some of them conveyed indications that Jeff was thinking along those lines. And, you know, from the discussions that I write about at D.E. Shaw, it's clear that the opportunity, that the idea started with the notion of an everything store.
And you get the impression from the outside that Jeff executes perfectly, Amazon has executed perfectly. But in the early days, in the pre-bust, 1998 and 99, he was investing in Pets.com, Cosmo.com, the bicycle messengers that would bring you cigarettes. He bought tools. He clearly was interested in broadening it, but invested in companies that were doing all these different spaces, and most of them complete flops. He made quite a few mistakes, especially early on.
Right, but also I think it's an irony now that all those businesses do exist, right?
Right.
Amazon has a very successful pet supply business. There's a website, wag.com, which is Amazon owned. Cosmo is being recreated now with Amazon Fresh and all sorts of other grocery services.
Too early?
Yeah, they were ahead of their time. Internet usage wasn't there, but also the capital climate changed,
right.
and you know, investors slammed on the brakes in April of 2000, and so none of these companies were able to mature,
right.
And they were reckless, I guess, in their spending because they saw, you know, they saw Amazon spending like mad, and they were trying to duplicate the strategy. And Amazon, which was kind of ahead of the pack, was able to throttle back and, you know, it had to lay people off during the dot-com bust and close a fulfillment center. But, you know, Bezos showed himself to be a kind of able steward, and Amazon survived. The rest didn't. He did make mistakes, and that, of course, is what makes the Amazon story so fascinating. In fact, I tell a story, in the book of the board, really, you know, considering whether that, you know, to ask Jeff to step aside or to step into a chairman role, you know, like Steve Jobs getting ousted from Apple,
right.
You know, they didn't quite believe, you know, that he was the guy to run the company at scale. And of course, over in subsequent years, he has proven himself and more.
I think you could argue he's one of the best, if not the best CEO in America right now.
I think there's no doubt. The list is short, and there's him and there's Larry Page and, you know, I don't know who else you'd put on the list. Howard Schultz, maybe. But clearly, you know, Jeff, because so many people counted Amazon out and saw it only as a boring retailer, and then, you know, inventing the Kindle, inventing Amazon Web Services, the cloud business, which is completely orthogonal from its core retail
no
business.
No kidding.
You know, he really has shown himself to be someone able to see around the corner, anticipate changes, and to use his brand of thinking to change every industry that he enters. He's very much like Steve Jobs in that regard.
Absolutely. Whose idea was Amazon Prime?
There was a kind of collective effort.
Because that's brilliant.
It was brilliant. I mean, it started really built on top of a previous service, Super Saver Shipping, which, you know, allowed people to get free shipping after they passed a certain threshold. And Amazon saw how popular that was when you remove the cost of shipping. And there was an engineer who I mentioned in the book who floated the idea of a shipping club. But Jeff recognized the importance of that idea, and he elevated it, and he put a SWAT team around it, and he gave the team like 8 weeks to debut it. And as with all these things that become kind of Jeff products inside Amazon, right. He just worked on it nonstop and asked a ton of questions. And even today, Amazon Prime Now is not just the 2-day shipping club, but it's a movie service, right. and a lending library. And that's, Jeff realizing that this thing accelerates spending on the site, and we're going to make it the core of our business.
I guess the lesson I got from this is that Bezos was aggressive, and this is part of the culture that he fostered, aggressive, risk-taking, learned fast. So he had failures, but he learned from the failures. He was quick to spot successes and go all in on those. And that kind of ruthless focus really has been very successful. You tell a story, and Orko in our chat room's reminding me of how Jeff met Larry Page and Sergey Brin very early on in Google. They had just completed a funding round. And Larry said, Jeff said, no, I want in. These guys are going somewhere. In fact, he's made his reputation as a savvy investor.
Yeah, that's right. It's not commonly known, but Jeff is an early investor in Google, which is unbelievable.
They're big competitors, right?
That's right. That's right. And for all we know, he still owns shares. Yeah. Of course, we don't know. But, he saw these two guys that were rethinking search online, even though it seemed at the time like a crowded market. And he saw how kind of stubborn they were about cluttering up the front page with advertisements, and I think he probably saw a little bit of himself in the Google guys. And he turns to Ram Shriram, who is an Amazon executive at the time and of course an early Google investor and Google board member, and Ram's his employee, so he's able to very persuasively say, no, I'm investing in the company. I went in. And Ram made that happen, and it's one of those historic curiosities of the internet. That Bezos really minced two fortunes in the 90s, one by starting Amazon and another by investing a little bit of money in a rocket ship called Google.
It is kind of amazing. You might be tempted to say, gee, the guy's lucky or his timing is really good, but it starts to add up. And after a while, you start to say, I think he's actually a genius. Do you think he's a genius?
I mean, I think there's no question. If you talk to Amazon employees, and the thing that you hear over and over is that they come into a meeting, or they prepared for months their 6-page document and their proposal for a new feature at Amazon, a new offering, and they come into the meeting and everybody sits down and reads the document in total silence, and then the conversation begins, and they all repeat very faithfully that Bezos has internalized and understood every single detail. He asks the best questions. He immediately identifies all the defects, and that if you're not prepared and you can't answer the question properly, that he'll get right in there and identify that weakness in a pretty devastating way. I mean, he's simply the smartest guy in the room in all these situations. And it's when you look at the history of Amazon and the way in which it's outmaneuvered so many competitors and satisfied so many customers, the record really demonstrates that as well.
It's Darwinian. It's not luck.
Of course, there's a certain amount of luck, but I think they kind of overstate that. I mean, Jeff would point to luck and fortunate timing, but he made his own luck. I mean, he saw the way the web was growing. He left his job on Wall Street. He doubled down and raised money when he could, and then he throttled back when he had to. And then he identified new opportunities as they came along and pushed the company into things like the Kindle when even his colleagues didn't believe Amazon should be building hardware. So, yeah. Luck, I think, actually plays a very small part in the Amazon story.
I have to agree with you. Now, Amazon very famously does not turn a profit. I mean, I guess, have they had any profitable quarters?
Yeah, they have. And some years, 2010-ish, they've demonstrated quite a healthy profit. But what Amazon's faithful shareholders understand is that the company hides its profits. It is profitable. Particularly its older businesses are profitable. But it is so relentlessly growth-minded and expansion-minded that it's plunging its profits back into new opportunities. And that's what they want. You know, they think it's still early on the internet and the land grab. And, you know, Amazon's investing in groceries and international expansion and new kinds of hardware and drones, maybe. And the shareholders are fine with that. But if tomorrow the stock market were to crash and a new orthodoxy on Wall Street demanded profits, Amazon would have no trouble doing that.
They've got revenue to spare, obviously. Huge revenues.
Huge, yeah, and they've been very vocal to their shareholders about going through growth phases.
So it's
that's the criticism, the rap against Amazon, that it's unprofitable. But you know, those aren't dummies that are pushing Amazon stock into the stratosphere. They're watching the balance sheet, and they see that company growing fast and taking market share away from competitors, and it gives them confidence in the future.
Amazon's exactly as profitable as it chooses to be. In other words.
It manages to EPS, no doubt, and it always hits its targets too. So it's become very reliable in projecting, the next quarter and hitting its mark. You know, it rarely misses. It'll show a loss, but it's always projected that a loss is a possibility. In a way, I think it's very purposeful. I think that Bezos and company see healthy profits as an attractor of competition, and they want to live in the thin atmosphere of low margins.
They're sandbagging us.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a pretty good anecdote in the book of Bezos talking to Bill Miller, an investor at Legg Mason, and Miller's asking him, is AWS, the cloud business, going to be profitable? How much are you going to charge? And Jeff says, I don't want to make the Steve Jobs mistake with the iPhone of charging so much for it that you become a magnet for competition and bring on competitors like Android. I just think it was a very revealing moment, and I don't think you say that Jobs made a mistake with the iPhone because it's been so incredibly profitable for Apple. But it shows the divergent thinking there of the two world-class entrepreneurs. And Bezos likes to stay under the radar and because I think he believes he's building ultimately the world's largest company and wants to keep competitors at bay until Amazon gets an order of magnitude bigger than it is today.
So is there a time, is there a moment in the life of Jeff Bezos and Amazon where he dials the knobs a little differently and says, okay, we're cashing in, baby?
I think that every couple of years they do have to kind of, the way they say it is, get back in touch with their ability to make money and show profits.
That's a very Amazonian way to put
it. Yeah, and so I think we're heading into a time when they will improve the balance sheet a little bit, just to make sure that they don't lose the confidence of some investors.
Right.
But then if I know this company, then they're going to be investing again. And they're going to be doing things like, bring in Amazon Fresh to 50 more cities, or coming out with a phone or a set-top box. And until I don't see the cycle ending until Bezos basically steps aside, because he's one of those rare, unique founders that inspires so much confidence from his investors. They're just willing to give him a lot of leeway to go and make these kind of unorthodox business decisions.
We are in, it seems, a little bit more of a mature industry, even in the internet, which is obviously only 20 some years old. And I look at Steve Jobs passing away and Apple struggling to keep its magic. I look at Steve Ballmer stepping out at Microsoft and the difficulty they are having finding somebody to replace him. Is Amazon, Jeff, has he created a corporate culture that can succeed Jeff Bezos?
Yeah, I think that's probably the key question for the future of Amazon, and I don't profess to really know the answer to it. I mean, there certainly are a lot of capable executives at Amazon, starting with Jeff Wilke, the senior vice president of the consumer facing businesses, like the retail business in North America. But the question is there really one other person versatile enough?
There's no one.
As fiercely intelligent enough to run Kindle, to run AWS, to run retail. I mean, I think a lot of these other executives are trained to think like Jeff thinks. So, you know, in a lot of the same ways as Apple executives today try to think like Steve. But, you know, it's going to be a different environment for the next Amazon CEO, just like it's a different environment for Tim Cook. You know, you don't have the same, you know, leeway from investors or the same faith from your customers. You kind of have to prove yourself more. So, that's the big long-term question facing Amazon. But look, yesterday was Jeff Bezos' 50th birthday. He's kidney stones notwithstanding. He's a healthy guy and he's young and he probably has decades running Amazon. And I know his mission isn't near complete. So I think it's an interesting question to discuss. But really, I think we're going to see Jeff Bezos running Amazon for many years.
Let's hope we got a long time. It's fun to watch him work. Yeah, he was evacuated from the Galapagos by the Ecuadorian Navy, whoever. I don't remember who it was. The Navy.
Because that's right.
His kidney stones were acting up.
Yeah, we don't have to think too deeply about that, but it's...
That hurts like hell.
It sounds like an unpleasant way to end a vacation.
You don't want that to happen. But he is in good health, right?
As far as we know, I don't have any special insight. It's maybe a cheap shot to say that technology companies have not proven themselves to be the most faithful reporters of that kind of information, but it certainly seems like he is... back at work and going to lead Amazon for many years.
And endless ambition, not just for Amazon, for himself. He just bought the Washington Post with his money. That's not an Amazon acquisition. He has a space, it's called Blue Origin, right? His space program. What else is he up to?
Well, he's got a venture capital firm, Bezos Expeditions. His family is involved in a lot of philanthropic endeavors. He's got four kids. But one of his talents is managing his own time, and it's why he's able to do so much of this. They also, I'll just say that all these things seem to be so different, but, the common thread is really, Bezos applying his mindset and really trying to change the economics of all these businesses. So with Blue Origin, he's trying to lower the cost of getting to space. They're really rethinking, the design of rockets from the ground up, trying to build a more economical and reusable rocket ship to create a tourism industry. And I suspect that's what he'll do with the Washington Post is rethinking the operations and trying to create a more economical way for journalists to speak to readers and vice versa. He really has taken that flair for reinvention from Amazon and just implanted it in a lot of different areas. I mean, from what I know of the philanthropic endeavors of the Bezos family, they try to think about problems like education in new and completely fresh ways. So, a lot like Steve Jobs, taking a kind of mindset and mentality and just applying it to different industries is really what Bezos is up to, overall, not just at Amazon.
It really is fascinating. I don't think there's any other era where a brilliant person like Jeff Bezos could have the scope that he's had. I mean, we're not talking J.P. Morgan or Rockefeller here. I mean, he is. It's not just an empire or financial success. He's not Standard Oil. This is so much more than that. And I can't think of any other era in human history that would give somebody like him the scope that the internet era has given him.
That's right, and that's the internet, and the fact that it has stitched together so many people around the world. And Jeff saw that earlier than anyone, to his credit.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I mean, 20 years, it's a 20-year-old company, and this year it'll probably do about $75 billion, and next year it'll probably do $100 billion, and it'll be the fastest retailer to get to $100 billion in sales in history. And the thing about these big discount scale retailers is that, size begets growth. You know, they can use their scale advantage to get better prices and to grow faster. So we're really seeing Amazon achieve kind of breakaway velocity. And it's unclear, even though the likes of Walmart and others have kind of assembled to try to slow it down. Google's investing in distribution now. It's unclear whether really at this point anybody can challenge Amazon. And if that's the case, then I think, we've got the first significant, credible challenger to Walmart in terms of, seizing the mantle of the world's largest retailer.
Bigger than that. You can't see. You're right. You reach critical mass. You can't. No one can compete. You just own it.
Yeah.
Is I mean, in 10 years, will we just be buying everything from Amazon?
Well, you know, the kind of corollary to that point is that I think e-commerce entrepreneurs have now understand that you can't start a company in Amazon's backyard. So, you know,
which
10
is
years
everywhere.
Ago, well, no, right? Well, no. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, Zappos decided, well, right, we're going to kind of do the Amazon for shoes. Yeah. And, it, you know, you run headlong into Amazon after
and they
a while.
Bought them.
Yeah, same with diapers.com. Right. But today's e-commerce entrepreneur is going to have an exclusive on a product, something that Amazon right. can't sell.
Right.
It's going to have, you know, it's going to go after a unique customer base. There's going to be some kind of defensible proposition, you know, an artisan, you know, kind of thing or something like that, that Amazon can't touch. I mean, there's a lot of manufacturers, you know, that don't want to sell on Amazon because it exerts downward price pressure and kind of obscures your brand in favor of Amazon. So I actually think there's a lot of opportunity left in e-commerce. And of course, internationally, there are a lot of markets that Amazon can't touch. But
in fact, Amazon very famously is not very successful overseas. They acquired a UK store. They acquired a Canadian store, but you can only buy Kindle in a limited number of markets. And is that going to change, or is that kind of a hard limit?
No, I think that they're finding new ways to enter markets, like introducing the Kindle, or in India going in with a marketplace instead of a first party business. You know, in a lot of countries they face entrenched competitors like the local indigenous Amazon or eBay, right. But they're finding ways to expand. Look, I mean, the size advantage they have helps them get into new markets. China, like a lot of other U.S. internet companies, they haven't had a lot of success, but they've recently introduced the Kindle and Kindle Fire there. So I think they're trying to get clever on how they tackle new markets, and I think more so than challenges, there's just a lot of opportunity in expanding the business globally.
You talk about Amazon being good at hitting its targets. One of the targets that nobody hit was how big Amazon was going to be. Jeff Bezos very early on went through the exercise asking people, well, how big are we going to get? His estimate, this was at a company meeting, was it Broomball meeting? And his estimate was the largest, and it wasn't even close. I mean,
right.
Even Bezos did not anticipate the kind of amazing growth that Amazon has gone through.
That's right. And that's probably, I think that meeting is in 97 or so. They had just gone public. And they didn't appreciate how Jeff was going to step on the accelerator.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't even foresee that when he could raise all that money on the bond market,
yeah,
that he would really just go for it. You know, he's a gambler in a way, or he's just an audacious bettor. And, you know, a lot of the growth is because they have gone for it and tried to exploit every single advantage that's available to them. Even they kind of discounted their own growth. Now, I would say if you have that meeting today inside Amazon, that they wouldn't be underestimating their own potential. I think they have a much better idea than anyone else what the opportunity is going forward.
It's such a great read. I highly recommend it. The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, Brad Stone. Its author, you could find out more at his website, brad-stone.com. He's also a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, where he has to quickly go file the Nest story.
Actually, one of my colleagues, Ashley Vance, did that while we were talking. But
how does that work?
Leo,
you don't have a beat? Like, is there an assignment desk, or is everybody just kind of, I'll write about that?
You know, at Business Week, we're so collegial, and particularly
awesome.
Ashley and I work so well together. Some of these things are kind of jump balls,
that's
but,
awesome.
You know, we try to help each other.
How fun is that? Anyway, great to talk to you, Brad. Once again, another great book. And as I said at the beginning, it's not just a biography of Jeff Bezos. It's not just the story of Amazon. It's really a business book that anybody who's interested in business in the internet age just has to read. It's just fascinating, and there's so many great lessons in there. Brad, thanks for joining us on Triangulation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Leo. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Triangulation is now at its new time, and I want you to watch live if you can, because your questions, your feedback through the chat room is incredibly valuable. We do this show Mondays now, 1 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific. That's 4 p.m. On the east coast of the United States. If you're outside the U.S., of course, 2100 UTC, you can do the calculation from there. Please do watch live. We like it if you do. But, of course, as with all the shows on Twit, on-demand audio and video available after the fact at our website, twit.tv, and wherever finer netcasts are aggregated and distributed to your listening device. iTunes might be one of those. Please subscribe. You don't want to miss a single one of these. They're always great. Do we know who is next week, or is it going to be a surprise, Kirsten?
Surprise.
It's a surprise. That means we haven't booked it yet. But Karsten Bondi, our producer, does such a great job getting great people in here. Fascinating stories, fascinating interviews. I know you're going to want to watch each and every one of them. We'll see you next week on Triangulation.